I wanted to talk today about hope and about making a way when it seems like no way is possible. Because sometimes it seems like there is no way forward. You heard the expression, you just can't get there from here. Sometimes it seems like there's no way to go sideways, not even any way to go back to the way things were. Mistakes can feel permanent. Decisions can seem impossible. It's like a traffic jam where everything is blocking everything else and it's just all frozen. Even the condition of an entire country can feel like a tangled and miserable Gordian knot. And like there's no escape no matter what you do, no matter who you are. Left or right or center, like anything you do might make something worse, so you just don't know what to do. We've inherited the work of those who have come before us, and our Unitarian Universalist Association rests on the shoulders of giants. And a lot of things they did in their lives give us examples of how to go forward when there just isn't a way forward. In the mid-19th century, Calvinist and Catholic ministers around the globe assured Unitarian or Universalist preachers that they were totally wrong about eternal damnation, that there was indeed a hell and they were going there. And the Universalists were pretty sure that was not correct. And so the Universalists read the Christian Bible over and over and over and over and over a few more times. And they memorized the passages that they wanted to argue from. And they refused to quit, despite the fact they were surrounded by a sea of folks who disagreed with them. Instead of quitting, they learned to reason and to debate with amazing passion. You all may have noticed this in some of our churches still today. We are good at debate and discussion, at thinking through things and looking for answers. Thomas Whitmore was an amazing Universalist preacher back then, and he challenged another man to a debate, and it ended up lasting for 5 days because neither one of them would quit. J.R. Lavelli, according to Richard Eddy in the book Universalism in America, Lavelli was a Universalist minister in Canada. He took part in a debate that only took 2 days, but each day it started at 6 a.m. and went to sundown with no breaks. Eddy said, people came for the entertainment, sure, but partially because the theology was so important to them. There were no judges in these debates. People went, they listened, and they went home and made up their minds. And of course, Lavelli hoped people would become Universalists, and quite a few of them did. When there was no way forward, we learned how to argue and think and read and learn and broaden out over and over and talk to people until sometimes a way made itself present just out of sheer desperation to make us shut up. Sheer determination, sheer pursuit of knowledge, sheer refusal to back down. Ain't going to let nobody turn me around. It was evident for us even then. One of my very favorite stories of our UU ancestors comes from one of my own distant ancestors, Reverend Noah Murray, who was a Pennsylvania Universalist and a distant relative of my dad's. And Murray began a Universalist church in the middle of Pennsylvania, and it very quickly became the fastest growing congregation within an entire day's ride. As you can imagine, this rampant Universalism did not sit well. He was sort of the mega church of the time, and the other ministers didn't find him very amusing. As free-thinking Christians flocked to the idea of a world free from the torment of hell, his church became larger and larger until it was so large that two local ministers decided this simply could not continue. Margaret K. Gooding and Philip Hewitt write, So they kidnapped Noah Murray and they took him to the basement of one of their churches where they kept him for 3 days and three nights arguing theology. Now, this is a true story, so I want you to think about this a minute. 3 days in a basement in 1808, 3 days tied up with little food or water, 3 days of having a Bible stuffed in his face over and over again by angry men, 3 days of being threatened with hell and damnation, 2 nights alone in the dark, tied up, accompanied only by the local rats. And on the third day, Reverend Noah Murray was set free. You see, he made a way out of no way, tied up and without food and dead tired and frightened and dirty. On the third day, he converted the other two ministers. And three Universalists walked out of that dark basement. One of the other two men was Reverend Moses Park. And in his church in Shequin, that was the basement they had been in, he converted the rest of his congregation within a month. And so even today, a plaque hangs on the wall recognizing what he did in participating in the kidnapping and that they indeed were converted. They became the first of 10 Universalist churches to spring from what happened in those horrible 3 days. I'm going to let nobody turn me around, even when it's dark, even when I'm frightened, even when I'm scared, even when the odds are overwhelming. I'm going to keep on talking. But time marched on, and by 1961, the Unitarians and Universalists had come together, and they continued to find a path where no path had been. Instead of two small, dwindling religions, we reemerged as the UUA and took strength from one another. And we were not afraid to dream of a world that looked different. We were not afraid to use human hands to shape and change the world until it began to look more the way we wanted it to be. The book, Faith Like a River, said that in March 1965, 600 civil rights activists gathered in Selma, Alabama, to join in the planned march to Montgomery, the state capital. And that march began on March 7th, 65, and that day is now known as Bloody Sunday. But on the outskirts of Selma, on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, marchers encountered a line of police 3 deep. They had guns and gas masks and billy clubs, and it got violent. Police charged into the marchers. It was televised nationally. And in Dorchester, Massachusetts, Unitarian minister James Reeb was sitting and watching television. Dr. Martin Luther King called on all people of faith to join him in Selma. He didn't say if it was convenient or if it was easy or if it worked for you or if there was a way for you to do this, please. He said, I need you here. And Reeb decided he had to leave his wife and 4 children alone at home and join 100 other Boston ministers heading for Alabama. And they gathered with thousands to march on a Tuesday and were turned back at that same Edmund Pettus Bridge. So they decided to try again on Thursday and went to an integrated restaurant to eat dinner. And after dinner, Reeb and 2 other ministers, Universalist ministers, Orloff Miller and Clark Olson, they left on foot. They were heading for the chapel where Dr. King was going to speak, and they never made it. They were jumped by a group of white men armed with sticks, and when it was over, Reeb had been struck in the head and hurt. And it was a nightmarish trip to get him to a hospital. They managed to find a black funeral home that had an ambulance, because no white ambulance company would come pick him up. And they load him in the ambulance and they begin to drive out of town and the ambulance blows a flat and no one will come. So they drive back to the town on the rim. Their black driver remembered a radio station where he used to work. And they drove there and they called for an ambulance from out of the area, which again took quite a bit of time to get to them. They headed for Birmingham in that ambulance, and Like a River says the news traveled quickly. Activist Jimmie Lee Jackson, a black man, had died 2 weeks earlier. There had been media silence, but when a white minister was beaten, it was everywhere in the U.S. President Lyndon Johnson was notified in the White House and sent a government airplane to take Maria Reeb to her husband's side. He sent yellow roses. James Reeb died 2 days later, and the country was so shocked. The U.S. Congress was so shocked that President Johnson sent the Voting Rights Act to Congress 2 days later. In his death, James Reeb said something to each of us, Martin Luther King wrote, black and white alike. He says that we must substitute courage for caution. Says to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered him, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy that produced the murder. His death says we must work passionately, unrelentingly, to make the American dream a reality so that he didn't die in vain. None of the people you've heard about today, not in the service, not in the sermon, none of them meant to change the world in the ways that they did. They simply refused to be limited by the brokenness of the world. They refused to be limited by what they should do. They refused to be limited by the lack of a way forward, the lack of a pre-traveled path. When there wasn't a way, they found a place where a path could be made, and they made a way. And you can too. Not by dying, but by living the values that you hold so dearly. There will be hope because your lives create hope. There will be hope because you live in such a way as to sustain hope. There will be a way forward because you say, you will not live in a world of dead ends and broken dreams. You are the difference, just as they were the difference. You are the change, one life at a time. You are living in a world partially created by your theological ancestors, and their work tells you that it's possible to achieve the miraculous simply by doing what you know to be right. So as you go out today, think about your responsibility to birth a new world into being. As you think about making a way out of no way in this country and this world, think of the words that I sang earlier in the service. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Gonna keep on walking, keep on talking. Walking up to freedom land. Don't let anyone turn you around. Change the world. Amen.